Thanks to Mr. Coya for sponsoring this episode of Show Me the Meaning. Head to MrCoya.com and enter the code SHOWME at checkout to receive 20% off your order, plus free shipping when you buy two or more shirts. Hey, everybody, welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast.
What is the meaning of this movie?
My name is Jared, and we're joined here with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Hey, film fans.
And Austin.
Hey.
And joining us again is Rebecca, the resident Matrix nerd.
Stop, y'all.
All right. So today I'm very excited about this podcast. Today we're talking about The Matrix Reloaded, the 2003 movie written and directed by the Wachowskis, starring Keanu Reeves. I'm starting to think we should rename this podcast The Keanu Cast. How do you guys feel about that?
Because
we did John Wick last week, and then 2 weeks before we did The Matrix.
Only if that means we can do Bill and Ted next week.
Oh, I would love to do Bill and Ted. Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey would actually, I think, be a very interesting episode. But anyway, I'm very interested to see how this is going to go, because, God, there is a lot to talk about. So let's get some first impressions, starting with Ryan.
Wow. Well, this movie, the first time I saw it was in high school, and it totally worked on me the first time. I saw like 3 or 4 times in the theater, and mainly because of the burly brawl, you know, where Keanu Reeves fights thousands of Agent Smiths, and then the highway scene. Those are pretty amazing cinematic spectacles, I'd say, that are not in any other movies, or at least at the time. But the rest of the movie, like after revisiting it over the years, and especially after revisiting this time, this movie is a total mess, and I'm excited to hear what y'all... How you can enlighten me about why or what the fuck this is going on in this movie,
because
the exposition sucks.
Challenge accepted from me too. All right, well, let's go with Rebecca next.
So I first saw this movie in college, and I think I really, really liked it, but I don't think I really got it until just a few years ago. I don't think I really understood like why it was so philosophically interesting. And so, I mean, I guess that kind of harkens to the conversation we were having the last Matrix podcast, where, you know, just because it's really philosophically profound doesn't make it an excellent movie. And I think that, yeah, so I had a really great impression of it. But I didn't quite get the impact until just recently.
Cool. And Austin?
So it's very rare that Ryan and I are like perfectly in sync. But this might be one of those episodes where it happens,
all
man.
Right.
I hadn't seen this movie in a while. And I had some impressions about it that were positive imprints. But then watching it last night, I found myself having a really difficult time. And I say that with qualification. I don't believe in black and whites in the world. Everything is variation, shades of degree, yada, 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 yada. So I'm just looking at this through a particularly salty lens in order to, you know, not just be like a waffling, qualifying philosopher. But I just don't dig it, you know? So I think that there are philosophical themes that are interesting, like we hinted at in the last episode. I think there are some fun scenes. I still dig The One. I still dig Neo. Trinity's still a badass. Morpheus is still cool. The scene with the architect doesn't actually piss me off. I kind of find it interesting. But fuck, man, this movie just doesn't hold together for me.
All right. So I would say, first thing you got to know about me, and if you listen to the last Matrix podcast, you already know this, I was looking forward to this movie very much. I stayed in line 6 hours early in costume to see this movie, and I saw it 6 times in theaters, and then I went through it's weird. My relationship with this movie is always changing. I said to myself about a year ago, I said basically what Rebecca is saying. I said to myself, oh, I finally get what they were trying to do now. After watching it last night, now I know what they were going for. So the first time I watched it, the first like 10 times I watched it when I was in high school, I had no idea what the fuck was going on. I didn't know what they were going for.
But you liked the movie, obviously.
I mean, you know, I was like, you got to understand, like, this was my, like, life, you know? So,
right.
I was convincing myself that I was liking it. And, you know, when I say I saw it 6 times, that was probably within the course of a week, you know? Like, I was just like, and plus, like, when I wanted to understand it, I didn't know what else to do except go see it again, you know? So, so then a year ago when Rebecca and I were working on a video, I felt like I got it, and I thought it was all about free will and determinism, which is still there. But then, again, watching it last night, I was like, no, there's another level here, and it's more about power structures and the nature of systems, both mathematically and socially. And I'm always like revising what I think about this movie and what I think the Wachowskis were going for. But I want to kind of frame this discussion. I just want to start with this. Imagine, Ryan, Austin, Rebecca, imagine that with your second film, you revolutionized special effects and inspired a whole generation to question their reality. Now you're expected to do it again, to replicate that impact, and you have a blank check. What do you do?
I don't do this.
Well, okay, but all right, well, let's just hold.
I can tell you what I do, though.
Well, I want to get to that. But I want to just let that simmer for everyone else who, for Austin and Rebecca, maybe don't know exactly what they would do. But I want to bring, when after the recap, I want to come back to this because I think they did what I would do. And even though it's a bad movie, I still think they deserve all the credit in the world for
trying
what they tried
to do. You would make a better version of this movie.
I don't know. Let's go into a recap quickly. Wish me luck on the recap. All right, so it's been 6 months since Neo realized his potential as the One, but he doesn't know what to do in order to fulfill the prophecy that will destroy the Matrix and liberate mankind. Meanwhile, other members of the Resistance realize that the machines are drilling toward Zion and have precious time before the last human city is annihilated. Eventually, the Oracle calls and tells Neo that the next step in his journey as the One is to seek the Merovingian, to acquire the Keymaker, and go to the Source where the path of the One ends. Meanwhile, Agent Smith returns and tells Neo that he is now free of the constraints of the system and is able to copy himself endlessly. He copies himself onto a human Resistance member named Bane and enters the real world. Neo, Morpheus, and Trinity meet the Merovingian, free the Keymaker, and Neo enters the Source where he meets the Architect, who tells him that the One is not a transcendent means to topple the Matrix and free the human race, but rather just another part of the system of control. The Architect gives Neo a choice: save Trinity from certain death and doom the human race, or do as his five predecessors have done before him and reinsert his code to the mainframe, reload the Matrix, and allow the human race to repopulate. Neo chooses to save Trinity, dooming the Matrix to further deterioration and Zion to impending doom. Just as Sentinels are closing in on the Nebuchadnezzar in the real world, Neo recognizes that something is different and inexplicably stops the Sentinels with his mind, then passes out. Both Neo and Bane are passed out after Bane has sabotaged a Resistance effort. To be continued. I want to say end of movie, but it's certainly not the end of the movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, guys. So I think I don't want to put words in Rebecca's mouth, but...
Mm-hmm. But if I were going to do so, this is what
I don't want to do... So let me just say I want to open it up. I want to open it up to Rebecca, but before I do, I just want to say this. Last time in the podcast, we talked about how serious the impact of the Matrix was on a generation and how it really did inspire people to question their reality, but also question other things. So we ask ourselves, as the Wachowskis, do you just, you know, you now are the head of this franchise that was stupendously successful beyond your wildest dreams. What do you do? Do you continue with the philosophical themes? Do you try to awaken a generation? Do you try to awaken an audience again? Do you try to replicate that? Like, how do you do that? Or do you just take the safe route and try to make a cool action movie trilogy, maintain the same distinction between good and evil, maintain the same themes, and just try to make a well-structured movie as well as you can? Well, in my opinion, they took their impact on a generation very seriously. They could have just made this two badass action movies that you know, basically make the machines the enemies. But no, they wanted to awaken their audience again. And instead of awakening them from reality, this time they awakened them to the system that forms their perception of reality. That's what I'm thinking they were trying to do here. But I want to throw this to Rebecca. So, Rebecca, in the last podcast, I said that I didn't think the world was ready for the philosophy in this movie. I didn't think they were ready for this new awakening the Wachowskis were trying to impart on their audience. And you said that what you were reading at the time, you were ready for it. So I wanted to ask, what were you reading and how do you see it reflected in the movie?
Yeah, so some of the ideas that I was looking at the time. So some of them were actually looking at the nature of reality and using characters that were suspicious about the reality that they existed in. Maybe they were in a parallel universe. Maybe, you know, there were all sorts. Maybe they were on a different planet, right? People kind of waking up was a big theme. Waking up into some kind of profound knowledge was everywhere at the time. And then this battle, this kind of epistemological battle between two different sides about whether or not the reality that you perceive is in fact real. And if it's not real, then like, how the fuck do you find out what is real? And then I think, what I think the Wachowskis do, and what I think the feminists also eventually kind of did as well, was to really, rather than saying, okay, there's this real and not real binary, they kind of just fucked up that binary altogether. You're like, no, let's really think, what if we challenged this idea that there's a real and there's a not real? And we started talking about something as if there's like a feedback loop, or right, as if there's this relationship between the real and the not real that isn't quite so easily distinguished as we would like to make it. And so that was definitely happening in the science and feminist science fiction at the time. And I mean, hello, Matrix. So that really seemed like something that was I was really open to, and I was excited to see, with like cool, you know, action sequences and some powerful women and that sort of thing. But I also think that it was a concept that was circulating at the time, especially in circles of people who felt oppressed. Black science fiction was also doing similar things at the time, right? Like this idea that the world that you're living in isn't real is really old. And it's an important thing that oppressed communities are constantly dialoguing about. So, in that sense, I was kind of prepared for it and open to it and excited about this joining a conversation that I already saw happening in these other really important spheres.
So my question is, when you're saying question their reality, that seems a lot like the first Matrix. I'm curious as to how those traditions of science fiction spoke specifically to the development of the philosophy of the first one in this second film. When you talked about kind of confusing the boundary between the real and the unreal, I think we're speaking specifically about the end when Neo stops the Sentinels, right?
Yes. But I mean, yeah, exactly. But there's something also that happens, right? Even at the beginning of the, at the end of the first one, right, where Neo comes back to life again in the real world. And suddenly the idea that one of them is the real world and one of them is the fake world stops making as much sense. Or like, you can't keep that dualism and make sense of what happens in that situation. So, so I do think it's a subtle theme that they sort of slap you in the face with a number of times throughout the second film. But I think it's there. I think it's there kind of regularly, especially when you start to think about the machines as beings that you thought were kind of maybe fake or kind of autonomous in some way, and they start to become more real and more lively and more effective in the second film as well. So then it becomes, so then, like, you know, if you're talking about what the real social is, where's our real society taking place? The society stops being the society of humans that are plugged in, that you imagine a society, and it becomes this like actual society, this relationship between machines and humans, and that's the society that you're real, that's the power struggle that you're really engaged in.
Right. So I'm gonna try and simplify this into the way that I have read the film most recently in last night's viewing, and I want you to tell me if this is kind of in the ballpark of what you're talking about.
Okay.
So with the first movie, I think that one of the reasons why it resonated so much is they basically took Plato's allegory of the cave and universalized it. And the reason why it resonated so much is because we were at a stage in society where we could imagine the cave because of computer technology, because of digital technology. We could imagine you know, I'm sure that maybe before this, when people talked about the allegory of the cave, and you know, you didn't know that there was a world behind you. All you saw was shadows. Perhaps people were like, "Oh, you know, but if I was in the cave, I would know." But now that we see computer technology increasing at such an exponential rate, it really resonated with people. So what I think the Wachowskis did is, all right, what's next? What's the next level of philosophy that you want to impart on your audience to blow their mind? And instead of disillusioning them from the idea that your reality may be artificial, I think what they did is that, so that they basically said that the Matrix is a system beyond the actual computer that humans jack into. Rather, when Morpheus says in the first movie, the Matrix is a system, Neo, he is even ignorant compared to what we learn in the second film, because what he's saying is that, oh, well, the Matrix is a computer-generated dream world that feeds off humanity. But what Neo ends up learning is that there is a greater system at play, that the system of the Matrix is actually a set of principles and procedures performed by governing bodies to perpetuate the system. In this case, the machines and the humans are trapped in this cyclical system that basically oppresses humanity, and in some way, I guess, also oppresses the machines that we later find out in the third movie. So in a metaphorical level, that's what Neo wakes up from at the end of Reloaded. It's not that there is a stark division between reality and unreality. If, once again, the Wachowskis in the first movie were trying to say, wake up, the things that you touch with your sensory senses could all be artificial. With this movie, I think they're saying, the system which informs the way that you perceive the division between real and unreal is also a system that needs to be transcended.
Yes.
Okay. So is that kind of, does that make sense, Ryan?
Yeah, it makes sense.
This is so interesting because the first film is generally thought to be inspired by Baudrillard's Simulacra and Simulation. And then I think we mentioned this before, but Baudrillard famously said, like, nah, they didn't get it.
That's polite compared to what he said.
Right. Interestingly enough, though,
he said they fucked up. Seriously. Yeah.
But interestingly, I think when you move to the second film, and this is only becoming apparent now through this conversation, but Baudrillard wrote some musings on the critique of political economy, particularly a film called The Mirror of Production, in which he criticizes Marx and political economy, so we'll say loosely capitalism or the critique of capitalism, and then he criticizes Marx's solution by saying that all of these ideas, whether it's advocacies for capitalism and the analysis of capitalism in the genre of political economy, or whether it's like the critique of political economy through Marxism, aren't revolutionary enough because they still fit within what Baudrillard calls the mirror of production. And he says rather than thinking of alienation or exploitation being something that is like leeching off of this pre-existent capacity to work that, you know, capitalists exploit and suck this like life power out of the workers, which is called like the extraction of labor power, right? Or the extraction of the expenditure of labor power in Marxist terminology. Baudrillard says that's not radical enough because that's still thinking that this idea of labor power is like this pre-existent capacity or pre-existent expression of human vitality. He says maybe even more radically than that, it's that real oppression or real alienation is that you're turned into labor power in the first instance. So before the extraction can take place, you're turned into a human battery, so to speak, in the terms of like the Matrix. So this whole system, the Matrix, is designed to feed this homogeneous symbiosis between machines and humanity because it incorporates, it monopolizes all of human life under its gambit. And then that's where alienation takes place as a second order activity. Does that make sense?
I think so. And I kind of want to transition this to the question, do you guys think that if this movie, I mean, in my opinion, and this could just be where I am personally with my intellectual development, I feel like people just weren't ready. And I feel like if the movie came out today, it might resonate more.
Absolutely not, Jared.
You don't.
You're fooling yourself. So like the craziest thing about going from Matrix 1 to 2 is that when the Matrix 1 came out, I mean, Yeah, that was their second fucking movie. And it looked like master filmmakers. Like, it is so tight. It's, even though it's 2+ hours, and just the way that they compose scenes and stuff, the momentum of the story is great. And then it's like in the second movie, they forgot everything. I think you're right that they basically were like, oh, wow, we blew everyone's mind on Earth. Yeah. How do we do that again? So we got to double down on all the philosophy, which was cool, but they just totally forgot the cinematic part yeah. about making a movie. Like, their storytelling sucks in this movie. Like, yeah, they try to set it up like getting into the social dynamics of all the people in Zion and stuff, but it just doesn't work compared to the Jesus story expertly told that we got in this dystopian, you know, way that we've never seen before.
Well, that's an interesting question. I wonder, is it just that the narrative or the philosophy that they were trying to impart in the first one, is that just more conducive to a cinematic experience
exactly.
than trying to explain like postmodern and like systemic, you know, stuff.
That's why I wanted to get to your first question, too. Like, what would I have done if I was the Wachowskis? I think they bit off way more than they can chew. They blew everyone's mind so much in the first movie, but they don't realize, like, the central idea to the Matrix, we are living in a computer, is like a character in the movie. That's like what people, what really resonates with the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like all you need to do in a trilogy is play with that. You don't need to go into the minutia of the fucking, you know, all the people involved, the Mary Anshin, the fucking literal key maker and stuff. I mean, like, give me a fucking break.
No.
And the free will determinism thing. Like,
well, I guess I'm saying, look, like, that would have been disappointing in its own way, because people, when they thought of The Matrix wasn't just an action movie. The Matrix was something that blew your fucking mind.
Yeah, but you don't need more than... I mean,
but that's what people wanted, and that's what they wanted to deliver.
That's why at the end of the second Matrix, all they had to do was go, guess what? The real world's also a Matrix. There you go. Mind's blown everywhere.
I don't think... That wouldn't have blown my mind.
Yeah, their cliffhangers sucked.
Like, it sucks.
Who gives a fuck about Bane?
All I'm saying is, when I said, all right, what would you do... I mean, to me, there's like a hierarchy. Like, you know, if you're a pretty cool guy, if you want to just create another action movie and, you know, continue to push special effects. But if you say, you know what, no, the first time we mixed philosophy, we awakened a whole generation and revolutionized special effects, and we want to fucking double down and do that shit again.
I think you can still do it. It's mind-blowing enough that we're in a computer. You can play around with that. You can even do this stuff.
No, they went the next level.
You can do it in a cinematic way, though.
But you're saying that basically it's just the same awakening. Basically just awakening humanity to a division between real and unreal. And then just
I've seen the movie five times. And I still don't know. I mean, I'm just learning stuff about
it
now.
I've seen the movie probably 35 times, and I'm still learning.
Yeah, is this epistemology standpointing? Is that what we're doing? I've seen the movie 6 times.
No, my point is that, like, okay,
they failed.
There should be no movie. You're probably right. On just a watching and enjoying a movie level, there probably shouldn't be a movie that you have to watch 35 times over a span of 20 years and still be trying to understand it.
Yeah.
But why?
Especially for a big budget. To Rebecca's point, that's just not where
philosophers were still trying to understand after that many
I agree
years,
with you, Rebecca. Yes. Yeah, there's movies like 2001 and stuff. I mean, there's movies that people are like still like, what does this mean? But this is different. This is more just like... Wait, what?
Real quick. Can I ask for a simplification of Ryan's criticism? So,
yes.
I agree that I think that the film at a narratival level really suffers. I think it's scattered. I think it's all over the place. I think it's disjointed. I think there's some bits that are just cheesy. It's too heavy-handed with some of the themes, like the determinism, purpose shit. I'm like, okay, we fucking get it already.
Yes.
But, Ryan, are you saying that you don't like it because you think it's just simply like philosophical and thematic and conceptual?
No,
and
that the narrative is weak,
whereas the first film was a cool story that also just happened to be profound.
I don't think that Jared's like, you can either do A or B. I think you can do a mixture of both, and you could have made all of the philosophical ideas boiled down with narrative economy like you're talking about into a very cinematic way like they did the first time, and then wow, I've never seen that before. I'd be so on board with that movie. They didn't do that. They made a very convoluted, this should be called exposition the movie. The whole thing is just dialogue scene after dialogue of like And it's right. played out like it's supposed to be a puzzle. It's supposed to be. I really do think that while they were writing it, they're like, oh man, when all of our fanboys on the internet go back and are trying to decode this, you know, once somebody's going to get it. But it's like, dude, like you said, you shouldn't have to watch a movie 35 times, and you know, and have to write down all the fucking dialogue. Like, it doesn't play well like a good movie. It plays like a play that was filmed with $1 billion budget, like a very masturbatory play.
All I'm saying is Ouch. That they did a fucking Hail Mary. You know, like, they fucking, yeah. I mean,
they
like,
went for it. They went for it. For I'll it. Give them that.
They I went mean. For it. And you know what? When you go for it like that and you fail, you just fail. You fall hard.
Well, like I said, know? Burly Brawl, it was when I saw that, we were literally cheering in the fucking cinema. Right. And that's very rare. You know, I was like, oh, that was crazy.
As a movie, this,
same with the highway.
As a movie, this film sucks. As a piece of action philosophy, it's rewarding the more you think about it.
Sure, I guess I'll give it that.
I feel like Rebecca and I should let them fight, and we can go off in the corner.
I want to hear what y'all think.
Can we talk about like superheroes?
End of
the
rant
for me. I feel like you know how I've said multiple times on this podcast, and apparently some people were talking about it on Patreon. Do you think that that Neo is a superhero of the left? Does he count?
He is, and I well
of the left.
Absolutely. This whole thing is, I mean, when I say that the next level of disillusionment beyond the division between reality and unreality, I think that this one is basically disillusioning you from capitalism.
Oh, okay. So it's an anti-capitalistic.
I think you could, well, at least this movie, I don't really know how it bakes into the third movie. I haven't seen it in a while.
They're definitely super left, right?
I don't know. I would imagine just from their movies.
Well, I mean, there's some real progressive themes in this. I mean, look at Zion, right? I mean, so in a very simple sense, in a very sort of like terse, like, okay, you've got an exploited class that are turned into literal batteries to like feed the machine world. They're like the upper class, right? And then, but there's still a symbiosis between them. They're both sort of connected somehow. So there's like a universal race that maybe we could transcend and. You can connect with them. I mean, there are like themes that would fit into a sort of Marxian or left or anti-capitalist analysis, but it's definitely not like it's not traditionally Marxist.
I was thinking more like Foucault type shit. So like, so there's the counselor Haman scene. I want to draw our attention to. So this is during the Zion scene, which is the first 45 minutes of the movie, which is god awful.
Yeah,
all of those scenes with Morpheus talking to Commander Locke and Morpheus talking to the whole auditorium sucks. All those scenes are bad. The soundtrack is cool. I like the rave scene. I would have liked it more if it was an orgy instead of a rave. But anyway,
I like the Rage Against the Machine stuff.
The Rage Against the Machine stuff is cool. But Counselor Haman says it makes one wonder, what is control? He talks about these water machines, and Neo says, like, no, we control these water machines that distill our water or that clean our air, because we could shut them off if we wanted to. But then he says, but then where would our water come from or our air? Really, what is control? And, you know, that whole thing, so there's two parts to that talk. After he says that, then he goes on to say, I know that that machine has a purpose. I don't know how it works, but I know it has a purpose. Similarly, Neo, I don't know how you do the things that you do, but I know that it must have a purpose too. So on the one hand, you can see how he's foreshadowing the determinist free will thing. It's like, you know, oh, you think that you're a badass and there's some sort of divine inspiration to your powers, but it could be just a cog in a larger system. But on the other hand, when he talks about the nature of control, I think that he is pointing to the fact that, you know, there is the ability to turn off the water machine is an illusion of choice that these systems, whether it be capitalism or whatever, put us under. And that's how these systems are able to sustain themselves, is by giving you that illusion of choice. I'm not saying that's what I agree with. These are not my beliefs, but I think that this is what the movie is trying to say to people.
Well, I mean, I know that was kind of like an abrupt, like, yeah, cool. But I mean, that's kind of what I was saying earlier with Baudrillard. It's sort of like a radicalization of a critique of political economy. So rather than just saying there are simply these two classes, these people have the power, these people don't have the power, the people with the power are extracting sort of like a value from the people who don't have the power. Rather than creating that narrative, it's taking place under a different set of parameters that I think are much more complex. And it is a sort of like post-structuralist, post-modern critique of power relations. Absolutely. And that's why you get people in Zion. I mean, you have women that are in charge everywhere, which is a really interesting move, right? You have people of color everywhere, which it almost seems like there are more people of color in Zion than there are white people, right?
Yeah,
which
very
is,
deliberate.
Which is, an important subtlety that they don't concentrate on, but it's very apparent. And if you look at the people who are on the board, who are on the panel of decision makers, first of all, you got Cornel West, who, if people know who Cornel West is. Cornel West is an academic intellectual who's a leftist. He's like a liberation theologian, leftist commentator, political activist. And then you got Roy Jones Jr., who's a fucking boxer, but a famous black athlete. And then you've got women who are the ones that are like the decision makers who are running things, right? So it's a really interesting way of disrupting these traditional power relations or dynamics. And this is kind of like what Rebecca was talking about, like how do you fit within these systems of patriarchy or these systems of exploitation? And so it is really fascinating from that level. And I think it is interesting. I was thinking about this last night. Maybe Neo is the superhero of the left that I always bemoan that we don't have enough of.
You know, speaking, yeah, so that's kind of my realization last night when I rewatched this movie, is that was a way of reading this film that seemed clearer to me now, but I had never really considered it before, because previously I had always thought of it as like, you know, the Merovingian talks about causality and the Keymaker talks about everybody has a purpose. And there's so much talk about Neo being able to make a choice. I always thought of about it as just determinism and free will. And that's still definitely there. But I hadn't seen the more kind of political anti-capitalist message that I think is very much there.
So, Rebecca, I'm assuming you agree with some of this, but my worry is, do you still think that the film is too dude-centric? Because you were talking about how you were reading a lot of like feminist sci-fi literature, and we talked about this a little bit in the first in the first Matrix, is that Trinity is still, she doesn't even pass the Bechdel test, right?
Right, yeah.
So do those concerns still exist in a second?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, but at this point, I mean, like, you know, just like show me a good science fiction film that is released to the masses, right, that passes the Bechdel test, and I will buy you a beer. It's just not very common. It's okay. So uncommon.
Gravity.
Yeah, I know. So beer, okay.
I'll take a Dos Equis.
So I'm saying, I mean, they exist, but they're just really, really rare. And even the ones that are trying to be left fail in some pretty major ways. I think it's still frustrating for me that's the case. That it's, you know, but they made strides. They made strides. The more interesting thing for me is the way that this sort of self-other relationship between the humans and the machines is really troubled. So in that sense, it's not, right? I mean, as Austin was saying, it's not this like simplistic, there's this oppressed class and then there are people who oppress them. Because as we learn, actually a lot of the machines don't like the system. Whether the system is as oppressive to the machines, right, as it is. I mean, in some ways that's kind of old school Marxist, right? Marx is really clear that the bourgeois are also oppressed, just not in the same way, to the same extent, right, as the proletariat, whatever. But I think that it kind of, for me, brings this like even more radical, like leftist critique to have this idea that there are these two parties, one of which is in power and one of which isn't in power, and then to be like, oh no, shoot, it's actually just this like system and we're all privy to the system and nobody's escaping it, and the machines don't have it, but they're getting fried by Neo, you know, or like they don't really have it that great because their whole life is indentured basically to this power structure. There are only a few machines who really hold actual power, have any real kind of control. So it's really, I think it even goes beyond just that sort of simplistic anti-capitalist or critique of capitalist position, and starts to really try and analyze what the kind of these founding concepts of self and other, and how those get troubled when you start to talk about relations of power that are not just economic or labor centric, but social and political and epistemological and et cetera.
Maybe I should have been. Yeah, I think it's not so much capitalism. I think that the more proper thing to have said was critique of power structures.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean when I say, would this movie have resonated more today, at least on a thematic level? Because you even hear terms like systemic racism is something that people talk about now. That's like a term that is in the popular parlance, because people now understand that when people say systemic racism, it's a system at play more than just the individual,
yes,
you know, people that are being hired in these places that exhibit systemic racism. So that's why I say, like, this movie might have been 20 years ahead of its time, because they were spewing a message that nobody had even that they just weren't ready for, that no one could even really grasp yet.
Interesting. So, because you're starting to make me to engage more with this film more than I wanted to, because I wanted to just come in like the salty, sour-faced, like, I didn't like this. And now I'm kind of like, fuck.
And
I
now you're like, Neo is the hero of the left. Oh, my God.
Yeah, goddamn you for changing my mind. But yeah, there is something interesting. So, okay. So, philosophically interesting, but it still doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? And does that detract from the potency of the film more than it was untimely?
Well, here's where
anti-cinema.
Well, here's I'm going to get real douchey. Right. They, you know, like the first movie is the hero's journey to a T. Uh-huh. In this movie, they just said, "I don't give a fuck."
Yeah,
you know, like they fucked up. Well, you know, like
no. If,
at the same time, that's also ballsy. I mean, it's not like they didn't know.
Yeah.
You think they didn't know? You think that they like? I'm sure they had the hero with a thousand faces probably tattooed on their backs when they wrote the first one, and they decided
like,
to throw it out the window. Yeah.
Exactly. They had the liberty after making such a great film. They had the liberty to like really take it where they wanted to go.
That's what you call cojones, Ryan.
But wait, don't
name another time that's worked.
That's why I'm saying it's cojones, because it often doesn't work.
The only time I can think about it working would be Godfather 2, where they totally just were like, we're going to take a totally different direction on how we're telling this story, and then it worked, and it won, you know, it's one of the best movies.
I mean, there are plenty of art films that work that do not follow the hero's journey, but obviously those aren't multi-million-dollar action movies that are supposed to appeal
Raid
to a wide audience.
Raid 2 was another one, you know. That was a totally different
movie.
I think that works with the hero's
journey.
Aren't
we missing the fact that they filmed the second and the third film at the same time? And so,
that's
super
a big deal.
So maybe the hero's journey does exist, but over the course of two films.
Yeah, so that's another thing worth talking about, is this movie, or these two movies, were meant to see back-to-back. They were supposed to come out at the same time. You're supposed to walk into one theater, see the movie, and then walk into the other theater.
No.
Yes, that was the Wachowskis' original plan, and through the entirety of production, Joel Silver promised the Wachowskis that was going to be the case. And then, of course, when they started realizing, crunching the numbers and realizing they could make more money if they delay it until Christmas, guess what happened?
That's insane.
One of my best friend's dad was in the camera department, actually, and filmed the second and third. And so I remember him talking about it in this context, that they literally filmed it, not even sequentially. It was, I mean, because, you know, you film based on locations and shit like that most of the time, right? So they filmed parts of what we call the third film, Revolutions, before they filmed parts of Reloaded.
Right.
So
that was a huge deal at the time.
It's kind of one script. So I almost wonder if we lose something by taking it out of its context, which basically means we have to have another podcast about Revolutions, right? Or Revelations,
or
whatever the fuck
it's called. Of course.
I got suspended for skipping school to go see Matrix Revolutions with my friend Matt Cervetti. We always think back. We're like, was that worth it?
As many totally times as I've seen this movie, I've seen The Matrix Revolutions very few times, probably less than five.
What?
Just because I was just tired by then.
Because
I agree,
the
like these
conclusion?
Movies, these movies are not good, and I think that all the good things about this movie you could say even less about in Revolutions. I think all the philosophical things we're talking about are more or less, extended through Revolutions. But in terms of just like, this movie is better to podcast about than it is to watch. Watching this movie sucks.
I will agree with that.
Yeah. Like, it's more interesting to look at the decisions that the Wachowskis made and look at their legacy and the cultural effect of The Matrix and how they used that to inform the direction they would go in the second movie. That's more fun to think about than to actually watch that movie and to watch the Merovingian, the Oracle, the Keymaker. Everyone talk about determinism. Everyone talk about choice and it being super vague and action scenes with no purpose.
That's a really bold statement because it assumes a kind of universal viewer who has who's going to have this singular perspective on what a fun movie is or what a good movie is. And apparently, I don't share the same opinions as this Universal viewer, because I do find it an enjoyable movie. I mean, I have to admit that I also liked Jupiter Ascending. So, I mean,
Hey, me too. I like that movie.
Yeah. You liked it too? Okay, great. I'm in good company. I thought, like, for sure I was going to
be and I fucking love Speed Racer. Oh, and everyone does, and everyone hates that, you know? Like, but so, I mean, I like their movies that not everyone likes. But this one, man, is just like, I just don't get it. How do you make The Matrix, like, a classic, and then you make all these other movies?
I just explained it to you.
I know, but how do they forget how to make a movie?
They didn't want to make a Morty movie. They wanted to make action philosophy.
The first one is so simplistic. I mean, it's childish compared to what's happening in the second two films.
No, no, no. It's a very well put together, a cinematic, visually told story. You could put that movie on mute and still kind of get it.
It's not easy to do what they did, and there is subtle masterful craft in The Matrix, but look,
philosophically, the first film, what they were achieving philosophically was child's play. So when you are trying to get at the sort of much more complex stuff, right, that they're doing in the second and third, you are going to run into the limits. I mean, maybe, I don't know. I don't know as much about film as clearly the three of you do, but I imagine you would run into some limits of the craft that there just might. Now, I'm not saying that you should excuse them from all these things, but as I was rewatching them, especially to write about for the YouTube video, I mean, I just could not get over how much they were trying to pack. For, you know, because I was looking at it as a philosopher, not as a cinema critic, which I'm decidedly not. And I was so impressed with what they were able to do in the second and third film. And they were only able to do it because they were like, we're going to ignore the fact that they're like just this huge, huge gaping, you know, plot holes everywhere you step, you know, but we can't deal with those because, or maybe some of them that you either can't deal with them because there's not enough time or not enough space or whatever, or because maybe some of those plot holes are really essential for being able to maintain the kind of tensions that you need to maintain when you're really trying to talk about sort of like paradoxical truths, and that you can't really express easily or in a linear narrative. I really feel like they were the second two films, even though they might not be enjoyable purely from a movie critic standpoint, I feel like there's a reason all three of them are taught in philosophy classes, not just the first Matrix, because they continue to be interesting, the second and third ones, and interesting maybe in a much more philosophical than cinematic way, but I don't think that makes them bad movies. It just makes them bad if what you want them to be is good cinematically. It could still be a good movie, but yeah, like Jared keeps saying, it's like a action philosophy or moving philosophy or something like that.
I'll give you that.
All right, guys, we're going to pause this very lively conversation for a second and introduce Brent, who is one of our patrons at wisecrackplus.com. If you want to join us to fight about movies on this podcast, check out wisecrackplus.com. And we got Brent on the line.
Hey, Brent.
Hey, Brent, how are you?
Great, how are you guys?
I'm doing great. You just caught us at a time. We're having a very heated, very lively discussion about The Matrix Reloaded, so you came in at a great time.
Ruh-roh. Okay, sounds good.
Good. Well, all right, first of all, I want to hear, you could be kind of the peacemaker. What do you think about this movie?
So The Matrix actually kind of inspired my career choice. I ended up, I'm like a computer engineer. So I was all about like all the tech and the phones and kind of the glamour on that. All the story elements kind of got left to the side on that.
Yeah.
So for the first movie.
Oh yeah.
So when the second movie came out, were you pretty excited?
Oh, I was first in line to watch it and watch it, you know, twice, and I was just completely overjoyed to see it.
And how has it? Did you watch it again for this podcast?
Oh God, yes.
All right. So after like years of it percolating, you know, is it a disappointment to you? Do you love the trilogy? What are your thoughts?
I still love the trilogy. It's mostly nostalgia now. Watching the cartoon level of CGI with the Burly Brawl and all that kind of takes a little bit away from it, but. You know, it still has a special place in my heart.
Yeah, his face looks really weird during that brawl, doesn't it?
Uncanny Valley.
It was cool.
Oh no, it's still cool. Like that car sequence still is unmatched.
Oh yeah,
I would say.
Oh yeah. I mean, last night I watched it six times. I just kept rewinding
the car
it
sequence?
And watching it again.
The only part that doesn't look good is when Morpheus is fighting the agent on top of the truck. You could just look very green screen.
Yeah.
So in terms of, do you engage or do you find the philosophy of this movie interesting? Did it inspire you to think in any new ways compared to the first one?
It actually did, because you know how the Oracle and the Architect are opposing forces. You got the black woman and the white man. You know, they're kind of like the yin and the yang, you know, kind of feeds into that Eastern philosophy a little bit.
Absolutely. I think Rebecca wrote about this in the video that she wrote for us on our
Matrix
Revolutions,
more,
What
Brent.
Went Wrong.
I'm on your side. I think it didn't age very well, but I still like the Burly Brawl, but yeah, these people are trying to talk me into the fact that it has a profound transcendental, it transcends like life itself, existence, determinism, and everything.
No, I'm saying that they were ambitious in their aims and their heart was in the right place. And unfortunately, their heart was not in the place of making an amazing, fun-to-watch movie.
Yeah, and that's where they fucked up.
Hey, Brent, you just jumped into the middle of a fight between Jared and Ryan. Forget them. Come hang out with me and Rebecca.
Yeah,
we're going to
go.
We're going to go have a beer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So one of the questions that I started this is asking, what would you guys do? Once again, your second movie revolutionized cinema. It revolutionized special effects. It awoke a whole generation. So I want to hear from Rebecca and Austin. What would you guys do? And Brent.
The first thing I would do is kill Neo and make Trinity the center of everything.
Shit.
I'm just kidding. I just wanted to be cliche for a second. So I'm not sure. So Austin,
feed the trolls.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Someone's got to. Okay.
Yeah.
Austin, if you want to go first, I got to think about this.
Okay. See, here's the problem. Because I have made art. Now, I've never had like an unlimited budget, but I am someone who was given lots of leeway. And what was one thing that I did among many other projects that I've made? I converted a Jean-Paul Sartre play into a tale of like the struggles during IRA, the IRA troubles at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for a month in a theater that seated 12 people. So when I'm given leeway, I do wanky, stupid art shit like that. That is also philosophically inclined. So I would do something like that, but with a $1 billion budget. So
basically, what they did?
Abso-fucking-lutely. And if you if you fail, at least you go out in a blaze of glory. Because fuck it, at least it was fun.
He put on Matrix 2 at the Edinburgh Fringe Fest.
Bro, I would totally do it. Like in the street, yeah. Like a musical theater version of it as well. So that's probably what I would do if I were given. I mean, I dig what they attempted to do. I just don't think that it was ultimately successful across the board, but sometimes failure can be spectacularly important, you know?
Like, Brent, what about you, man?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Absolutely. So I actually liked it because I did some research before you guys called into me. And I liked how they actually did some computer stuff with the second one. So Trinity, so when she's breaking into the power station, she actually uses a real life SSH exploit. So that actually was kind of a shout out to the computer community, which wasn't as mainstream at that time as it is now.
What about, another computer thing I found interesting about this is that, so we have in the first movie, we have 101, which is Neo's number. It's the number of his apartment. And then he is the one. It's kind of like this. And it's kind of this thing that follows him. And then in The Matrix Reloaded, it's interesting because it, almost to parallel the, in the first movie, he's like this transcendent holy figure. He is the one, 101. But now in this movie, it takes on a more technical meaning. We see 101 a lot. And correct me if I'm wrong, Brent, but 101 is binary for 5, which
yes.
In a computer is the 6th number, right? So now we're meant to contextualize 101 as him being the 6th incarnation of the one.
Yep, 6th iteration.
So what's brilliant about this is that, once again, as we're talking about, that the first movie is about like a holy what's the word, the holy prophecy. And in the second movie, we find out that that holy prophecy is just another cog in the machine, another zero and one in the computer.
Don't you guys feel disappointed on that? I mean, you know.
In what way?
And I don't know.
Does it make a good movie? No. But is it cool? And am I like kind of geeking out a little bit talking about it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I bring up one more detail of what I would do in my Matrix sequel?
Yes.
Is that like one kind of cliffhanger or idea that I think at the end of the first Matrix you're kind of left with is, what if Neo, the one, you know, flips the switch and then all humans wake up from the Matrix? I kept waiting for that scene, which we never really got, you know, kind of.
Right.
Like, so how awesome would that be in the second movie? It's like Neo flips the switch, kills the machines, and then all of a sudden it's left for humanity to rebuild. But then you get into all the same issues we did before.
Well, my thing with that is that people want to see the scenes in the Matrix. People want to see Keanu Reeves doing Kung Fu.
Maybe there's still Agent Smith and Kung Fu. Maybe there's still the Matrix. Maybe they use the Matrix and become like a Ready Player One society.
I mean, I hear you. That would be cool, but...
Cooler.
No, it wouldn't be cooler because I see why they didn't do it, because you want to see Neo doing badass stuff.
You can
stuff
still
in the
have
Matrix.
Him doing that. That's what I'm saying.
And not if the Matrix is done.
No, you can have a cooler version of it with still viruses and stuff. Anyway,
I actually want to hear more about some of the computer stuff in there.
Oh,
Brad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what she actually did, she used a real life tool called Nmap, which is a network mapping device or a network mapping software. And what that does is that scans a computer. And it listens. It says, "Hey, what is this listening on? What port is this listening on?" And then you find vulnerabilities on that. And then so she actually used that to real life, like a real pen test or a hacker would use it. So she scanned the system, found that the secure shell SSH was vulnerable, and she did what's called a buffer overflow. So she sent it more data than it was expecting to handle. It overwrote the program, and then that's how she was able to own the system.
I got a question, Brent. So they call the room that Neo goes to meet the architect, they call it the source. They don't call it the end. They don't call it the door. They don't call it, you know, the final room. They call it the source. Is there any kind of programming term that makes that term relevant, that they use that?
Well, no, I think that they're in the architect's room, and then there's the door to the source.
Right.
So he's like, you're going to go in that door, and then you'll re-inject your source code and reset the Matrix, and then everybody in Diane will die. You'll choose the six people, and the loop will continue, because there's a programming loop, and then there's also source code. Source code is what you originally program.
Did you study math for your computer programming education?
Yes. Yeah. Math is very math intensive. A lot of Boolean, a lot of binary, like you said, hexadecimal. Variables are arithmetic and some trigonometry.
Are you familiar with Kurt Gödel and the incompleteness theorem?
No, I am not. No, I've never heard that.
Okay. So I've heard that basically in the early 1900s, Gödel was a mathematician, and basically he did this thing called the incompleteness theorem, and he demonstrated that any formal system is inherently incomplete and that there is an anomaly in every system called a Gödel sentence. And I guess... this is reflected in that mathematically, and we actually just spent the whole first part of this podcast talking about how the movie comments a lot on social systems, but it's interesting how it also works on a level of mathematics systems, and how Neo is that mathematical anomaly. He is the incompleteness theorem in Gödel's work.
Also, there's another thing I was trying to think about when I was preparing for this podcast was, you ever heard the old saying, if I had a big enough calculator, I could calculate God?
I've not heard that, but go on.
But basically, it's like if you have like all the variables in a system, you know exactly what any arithmetic, you know, is going to happen with that. So if you have if you know all the X's are going to be ones, you know, X plus X, you know it's going to always be two. You know, so if you have everything, you know, kind of managed down to a subatomic level, you can predict things. So that's why they have these prophecies, and I think that's how they know how things occur outside the Matrix.
Right, and I think that's kind of the Merovingian's entire speech makes this point that we're all slaves to cause and effect. We can't truly choose. Neo thinks he's choosing freely, but his existence is really just a predictable inevitability in an imperfect equation. So I think that.
Yep.
That's kind of what Neo realizes, is that if you have a computer that's big enough, then it's not that you can become God. It's that you realize that God is just a part of the system.
Yep, exactly. Can God create a rock so big that he can't move it?
Yeah, in this case, no. And
holy fucking shit.
And more to the point, talking like, you know, we talked about how, all right, Wachowski's awoke a generation, what's next? But on the other hand, it's just like, all right, well, the Wachowski's just ended a movie with a character basically becoming Jesus and having infinite power. What the fuck do you do after that? You know, how do you create a conflict? And I think
you turn him into Darth Vader.
Without having... What does that mean?
You make him evil. I don't know. You keep the story going. I'm just giving
you
an example.
Well, he is keeping the story going, but instead of retconning the whole first movie, you basically say, all right, you know the whole Jesus thing? Well, that's just part of the system of control. I mean, I think that that's relatively a smart thing to do.
It's a thing to do.
But so you would have made Neo evil. Is that what you're saying?
Saying that that would have been, you know, a way you could have taken it. It would have been interesting, but... I don't know what we got.
Remember how I said at the beginning that this might be the podcast where Ryan and I disagree? I think that we have sharply diverged at some point.
Because the other thing, I mean, I hate to be the one who keeps making this like maybe simplistic point at this juncture, but I just think that the whole point is that good and bad don't exist in the same way that we imagine them to in the films. Like that's one of the things that the second and third films are trying to do. So you couldn't just make him evil. That would like just miss the whole point.
It's like we couldn't just make it a. Oh yeah, okay. Well, that's,
you know
that's
what?
True.
This kind of comes back to the rave scene. So to Rebecca's point, by the end of Revolutions, we learn that there's like a false dichotomy between the earthly good humans and the cold bad machines.
Yeah.
But then why do we have this rave scene at the beginning where we see this passionate tribal earthly celebration and affirmation of life? I wanted to see the equivalent of that for the machines in the Matrix Revolutions. What is the machine's ritualistic affirmation of life? I wanted it to be Neo goes in to the machine city and with his limited perspective, he has this fucking like acid trip like experience where he is experiencing the machines.
It's just all the Agent Smiths melding together in this crazy weird computer orgy thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why isn't that? What the fuck, Wachowskis? That would have, you know, had it be more balanced.
Yeah, I'm all for that. That would have made it better.
But, I mean, isn't it also, I mean, I always feel like I end up just defending these things as if, like, I just think they're the best movies ever made, and I'm always like, no, but guys! there's something to me about, right, like, the if we're looking at the machines and the humans as if they're representing this sort of really old concepts of the self and the other, right? Part of the struggle of affirming others, or affirming, and by other I mean kind of entities that are understood to be secondary or tertiary, or who are defined in existence to the self, right? Or they're defined by differentiation. So you're the norm and they're the other, right? The whole point is that you don't ever get pure access to this other. You never totally get to see who they are in all of their purity and glory and essence. And that shouldn't be the point. You shouldn't need that in order to like act justly toward them, right? Or in order to make good decisions with their well-being in mind, or in order to like engage in politics with them, etc. So, I mean, again, this might be like a bit of a stretch, but it does to me in some kind of way make sense if part of what they're doing in the film is trying to carefully negotiate this way in which the machines map onto the self-other relationship with the humans, then there's a way in which you shouldn't really need that sort of like, oh, now suddenly I am one with the machines, or now I understand them fully, because you're with the humans, you're siding with the humans, and you get glimpses of that. And that's sort of like, for those of you who are attending to that, that's enough. To get those glimpses is like, that's the call, the ethical call, if you're like Levinasian about it, right? That's the call. But you shouldn't need more than that in order to have like some kind of curiosity satisfied or something like this.
Right, but Neo gets it anyway with the character of Sati and her dad.
Yes, but he doesn't get the... Like, yeah, but I totally agree. Wait, I'm the one that argued that in my movie, in my video. So yeah, I totally agree. But I'm just saying, right, in response to this idea that maybe there could have been this like wild machine orgy, why didn't we get such a kind of affirmation of machine life? I think that might be one of the reasons, because withholding that is maybe this gesture toward a more kind of ethical negotiation with those folks than a pure like an unveiling of their like whole society or their whole nature or all of their essence it would have necessarily have been.
Did any of you guys watch The Animatrix?
Oh yeah.
Did you guys see the was it the new Renaissance, I believe? The part one, part two?
That was the origin story, right?
Yes. So I think that kind of answered like that even though it kind of seemed almost like a site like extended universe kind of thing. But I think that kind of answered like, you know, their history and they created the city of 01 and the cradle of civilization, you know, and raise their descendants and stuff like that. And they wanted to be like human and be like on their own. And then in the history that the humans actually attacked them, at least, you know, even though Morpheus doesn't know who struck first, it kind of implies it that the humans started bombing them first.
That is just not a surprise at all. You know, is it? Of course it's not. Humans always strike first.
Right. But I guess then the point is like at some point you have to, I don't know, like put the past aside and just, you know, embrace each other.
I think that's what the Matrix is all about. That's what the trilogy is all about is the one, you know, iteration that actually changes everything instead of doing the same loop over and over again.
Exactly. He transcends the system. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Brent, for joining us and really, really appreciate everything that you do, all your support. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you.
All right. My pleasure, guys.
We can go ahead and move into the mailbag. We can do a quick mailbag if you guys would like.
I mean, here's a John Wick question from Cayman. Jared, you said most people who watch John Wick forget about the wife and just view it as a dog owner's revenge film. I think the wife is the entire point. Throughout the film, characters are always saying, bro, it's just a dog. But that statement draws the audience's attention to the fact that it's not just a dog. It's John's last emotional connection to his dead wife.
That's fair. I mean, obviously, it wouldn't mean as much to the character if it wasn't a final gift from his wife. As you mentioned earlier in the last episode, there is that element of transference. The one thing I will say, though, is why not just have it be, you know, just like Death Wish or any of these other revenge films where it's just someone killed my wife and now I'm going to go ape shit, like Max Payne, you know, for video game people. And I think that like that because that's a little bit tired. That's a little bit of a cliche. So I think by adding the dog as kind of that middle ground, it makes it a bit more fresh.
Well, and also is that like that element of you know, one little action by one idiot, you know, can have all this such dire ramifications. And that's kind of a cool idea for a movie.
Yeah.
You know,
can I just give a shout out real quick to Lucy, who sent two awesome emails about John Wick. And if I can just summarize the second one, because it was kind of a long one, and she even admitted, she's like, sorry for being long-winded, but she basically was talking about the fight scenes and why she thought the fight scenes in John Wick were so much more realistic than even the Jason Bourne films. And she talks about, like, in MMA, if you watch MMA fighting, she says you'll notice that there are pauses or silences that are much more common. They break away, they struggle more, and you can even sometimes see a fighter thinking how to get out of a sticky situation. And John Wick does this. The silences can be prolonged, especially because he often takes a fight to the ground, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu style. And then you can see how John seems to coldly and carefully pause, even as he's being choked to death and considers how to turn the tables. And so I thought that was something that was actually that perfectly hit on kind of what we were trying to articulate about the fight scenes in John Wick and why they're much more realistic and how they're very different from, like, as we were calling, like, the ballet dance choreography that you get in a lot of, like, The Matrix, for example, martial arts films.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I guess Google must be listening in on all my thoughts because I got a lot of YouTube recommendations of, like, Joe Rogan talking to some martial arts expert on his podcast about how Keanu Reeves is such a badass in John Wick and how he does all of his, he gets all the jiu-jitsu right, and, you know, they were watching, like, training videos and stuff, and I don't even listen to Joe Rogan on YouTube. It just, Google's fucking reading my mind, knows that I watched John Wick recently. So, yeah, I'm on that same level, Lucy. I kind of thought that Lucy wanted to, we need to fly Lucy down. You guys are going to fight each other. Get your MMA stuff.
I'd pay to watch that.
Cool. All right, well, I think we're going to wrap it up for today. Thank you so much. Thank you to Brent for joining us. Thank you for Ryan for tolerating our philosophical banter.
It was great.
Thank you to Rebecca for joining us on this philosophical apologism of this movie. Hmm. And thank you again to Austin for mediating. And thank you to Austin for having quite a journey from hating this movie to realizing someone has finally made a superhero for the left.
I can change.
You can change.
I can change.
All right, guys, that's it from us. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you whenever we decide to do The Matrix Reloaded. But the next movie we're doing is Incredibles 2.
Oh, hell
so,
yeah.
So join us for that one.
Where can we find you on the internet, Jared?
Oh, you can find me at Father of Woody on Instagram.
Dog pics.
Dog pics all day. And at Wisecrack on the Twitter.
Rebecca, where can we find you on the internet?
Jesus, nowhere interesting. If you want to go to academia.edu, you can find some of my papers.
All right. Austin.
Hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, and you can tell me if there are other superheroes of the left that you find interesting.
Because he can change, ladies and gentlemen, he can change.
And you can find at Ryan Shorts or Ryan's Game Show on YouTube or Facebook. I just released one called The Oceans Conspiracy, where we dig into the link between the Oceans movies and the Russia investigation.
Some people are going to think it's a real video.
It's a real video. It is a real video. Go share it with your friends. Spread the word, everybody. Let's blow the lid off this operation.
Hashtag resistance.
Yeah.
You're the new superhero for the left.
That's right. Fuck Trump.
Yeah, I'll take it. I wear a cape.
All right, guys. That's it. Thank you again. Peace.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California.
Peace.
Ciao.